From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 7th day of July 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services. He's in Oakland, Illinois. And later in this half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with Matt Blaisdell of the Andersons Climbers Facility in Delphi, Indiana. In today's agricultural news, the Obama administration is trying to add a little clarity to why U.S. EPA is so late making an E15 decision. The Brazilians have made a visit to Colorado to look at the wheat crop there, and ASA has outlined its top legislative priorities. Full details yet to come. In the second half hour of our program, we call that The Farming World, and you can hear it online anytime you'd like at willag.org under the Closing Market Report heading, or on many of these radio stations. We'll talk with Kevin Cocannon. He'll help us explore the Obama administration's childhood obesity initiative. At the bottom of this half hour, we'll talk with Drew Lerner. He's at World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City about the agricultural weather forecast, and it all happens on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
In Chicago, on this Wednesday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. Nearby July wheat at 515 and three quarters, up 23 cents today. July hard red in Kansas City at 537 and a quarter, up 24 and one half cent. July corn futures, 370 and three quarters, up 10 and three quarters. September at 378 and a quarter, 10 and a quarter higher. And December corn at 389 and a quarter, up a dime. March contract, $4 a penny and a quarter, 9.5 cents higher. The May at 409, up 9 1/4. July soybeans, $9.93, up 28 and three quarters. The August at 967 and three quarters, 27 and a quarter higher. September beans at 941, up 28 and a half. And November futures at 932 and a half, up 32 and a quarter. January futures at 939 and three quarters, up 31 and a half cents. The November's, by the way, were 32 and a half higher, not 32 and a quarter higher. July bean meal futures at $304, up $6.80. July soybean oil at $36.81, up 97 cents. August live cattle futures, $90.50, 70 cents higher. The October at 91.87 and a half, up 77 and a half cents. August feeder cattle at 113.55, up 2 1/2. The September futures at 113.82 and a half, up 25 cents. July lean hog futures, $78.87 and a half cents, higher by a dime on the day. And the August futures at $80.82 and a half, up 55 cents on this Wednesday afternoon. You are listening to the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at the hour. Crude oil futures, $74.64 a barrel, up $2.13. Ethanol at $1.58 and 4 cents, up 2 4 cents. Natural gas, $4.58 and 8 cents of a cent, down 9 3 cents. And the RBOB at $2.02 and 6 cents, up 5 1/2 cents for the day. Heating oil or diesel fuel, $1.98, and that is 6 3/10 of a cent higher. And the gold futures at $1,198.60, the settlement price here, up $3.80. The Dow Jones Industrial Average just about 184 points higher at 99.28. And the Goldman Sachs at 491.56 is up 10.79. The S&P Index at 1050.18 is up 22.12 on the afternoon. The weather forecast for the day says some additional thunderstorms may happen from Missouri right on through Iowa and maybe into parts of Illinois. Some of those should be locally heavy. Thunderstorms with some will be scattered all over the eastern Midwest locations tonight right on through Friday. Relief from the dryness is expected from southeastern Missouri to Kentucky and to far southern Indiana Thursday and Friday. The second frontal system should bring some dryness relief late this coming weekend and early next week, though Drew Lerner will tell us a bit later in the program that those rainfalls will be very scattered and lightweight in many areas, though most places will really receive some rainfall. But not much by his accounts. We'll talk to him as we get to the bottom of the hour right here on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report.
Learnerd Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnerd Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgro seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnerd Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
I'm Todd Gleason. This is the Closing Market Report on a Wednesday afternoon. Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, joins us now to take a look at an up futures markets for Wednesday. Thanks much, Paul, for being on the line today.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Yeah, much explanation about why we jumped the marketplace?
Well, you know, a couple of things that did jump out at me. Of course, the Soviet Union, the new lands, it's too wet and too dry, and they love to sell wheat cheap, and they've got major crop problems. Looking at the crystal ball, crop ratings probably next week will probably be down on corn and soybeans once again. We anticipate crop acreage because of planting problems and abandonment and preventive planting to be a little smaller, both in corn and soybeans, than what the government acreage report is. I think there's confirmation out there that maybe they did overestimate last year's corn production. There's a lot of damaged corn out there. The test weights are low. We see a lot of volunteer corn and soybean crops, and the corn got there some way. And, you know, industry is talking about some poor yields on some byproducts and industrial use. The other factor, I think, more than anything else, is that there's some denitrification, uneven corn. And I think the market was a little short as well. So we had some excitement in here. And the other little tidbit that I wanted to share with you is that China's probably this coming year going to be buying 1 million tons of soybeans a week in order to take care of their big appetite. And I think that's something that the market's noting as well. And also, I think we're going to have to bid for corn acres next year, and that all helps out the bottom line on the dips in the marketplace.
Does this tell you that you want to be friendly to bullish the marketplace, hold and new crop both for corn?
I think as far as I think that we will see some improved prices.
Mm-hmm.
And one tool that a farmer can use, of course, is storage. And I think that we will get some better prices next year. Also, we're getting a lot of reports of gray leaf blight in the farms, in the cornfields. And several people are, you know, both in the north part of the state and the south part of the state are spraying, you know, I think Headline, I think, is the chemical they're using.
What do you suppose a producer ought to be considering?
And the trend is up, too, Todd, in the corn, soybeans, and wheat at this time.
Okay, so we have a trend higher. When we get to the report this week for the WASD, the World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates, do you expect to see both a smaller number for carryout this year and next year for corn and for soybeans?
Yes.
By how much?
Well, I think the number that I used on the corn number. You know, I think the old crop corn carryover is going to probably be somewhere in that 1,350, and I think the new crop corn carryover could be something like 1,1 to 1,12, something like that. So it's definitely a tighter situation, yeah.
Yeah, so it'll be fairly tight, and I guess we need to hold on and sit back and wait for the ride then.
Yeah, and not all weather guys are as dry as Drew. I think the three others that we watch very closely are a lot wetter than Drew, so you might ask him about that situation.
Okay, well, you know, I talked to him already, so I can't. I talked to him a bit earlier.
The weather community that I talk to is saying in the next several days, and then there's another one, that there's going to be quite a bit of rain, and that goes for our poor pals down in southern Illinois. It's very dry down there, and also the North Delta.
Yeah, I was making some adjustments between his very early morning forecast and the one I talked to him around 11:30, and I think he got drier between the two. He's still not particularly dry, and you'll hear him talk about quite a little bit of rainfall, but he's thinking it's much more spotty maybe than his first thoughts and what he saw earlier this morning. So we'll find out, and we'll talk to many weather folks over the time frame, and they'll give us a good idea, too. Paul, thanks so much for being with us
today. Have a profitable day.
Hey, you too. Paul Cooley is with ADM Investor Services. He's in Oakland, Illinois, and joins us here on the Closing Mark Report. That happens on a Wednesday afternoon.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
In today's agricultural news, the Obama administration has released a report explaining the goals for testing E15 fuel in on-road vehicles. The report appears to be in response to recent criticism following missed deadlines for the Environmental Protection Agency in reporting results. The administration report says EPA, working with the Department of Energy, undertook a multi-million dollar testing regimen that will provide the information EPA needs to make a sound, technically correct, and legally supportable decision. One component of the testing focuses on the useful life testing of vehicles. That testing has been ongoing 24 hours a day at essentially all of the independent test facilities in North America. According to the administration, under this accelerated protocol, each vehicle requires testing for 6 to 9 months. Testing of vehicles covering 2007 and younger is expected to be completed by the end of September. Testing of older vehicles covering 2001 and 2006 models will be completed in November. Further approval steps, including testing on dispensing equipment, changes to state laws to allow for the use of E15, and the completion of the fuel's registration process by the industry. Well, Brazilian wheat traders have visited Colorado. Wheat buyers, representing some 70% of Brazil's wheat imports, traveled to Colorado last week to view harvest and talk with farmers there, millers and exporters too. Along with a Colorado banker, the tour was sponsored by the U.S. Wheat Associates. Brazil was the 14th largest buyer of U.S. hard red winter wheat in the recently completed 09-10 marketing year, purchased something along the lines of 153.3 million metric tons. It also purchased 116.3 million metric tons of soft red winter wheat. And finally today, the ASA has outlined its top legislative priorities for this year. Leaders of the American Soybean Association say they'd like to see a retroactive extension of the biodiesel tax incentive, enactment of the pending free trade agreements, and ensuring that producers are not adversely impacted by climate change legislation. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. Monday was a national holiday, so USDA yesterday released its crop progress report. It showed that nationally, 19% of this year's corn crop was at or beyond the silking stage by the week's end, 11 percentage points ahead of last year, 7 points ahead of the 5-year average. While silking was at or on near normal pace in Iowa, Minnesota, and Nebraska, above average temperatures coupled with adequate soil moisture levels in recent weeks had pushed progress to 27 and 23 percentage points ahead of normal in Illinois and Indiana, respectively. Now, overall, 71% of the corn crop reported in good to excellent condition. That's down slightly from the ratings last week, but equal to the same time last year. In Iowa, the percentage of the crop rated good to excellent declined 7 points from last week, as excessive rainfall in the previous weeks led to increased yellowing in some fields and poor emergence or drowned plants in others. Soybeans, July the 4th, soybean emergence had advanced to 97% complete, slightly ahead of last year, but on par with the 5-year average. Blooming advanced 14 points during the week as mostly warm temps and adequate soil moisture levels provided ideal growing conditions across much of the major soybean-producing region of the nation. By the week's end, 23% of the 2010 soybean crop was at or beyond the blooming stage.
10 percentage points ahead of last year, 3 points ahead of the five-year rolling average. Overall, 66% of the soybean crop reported in good to excellent condition, down slightly from the ratings last week, but equal to this same time last year. And winter wheat producers had harvested about half or 54% of this year's winter wheat crop by the week's end, 4 points ahead of last year, slightly ahead of the five-year average. With over 5 days suitable for fieldwork, harvest was most active in Indiana and Ohio, where 34 and 40% of the winter wheat crop was combined during the week. Overall, 63% of the wheat crop reported in good to excellent condition. Now here are the statisticians with updates from their regions.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Baesdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
This is Brad Schwab, chief crop statistician with the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Illinois field office, reporting on crop progress and conditions for the week ending July 4th. Below normal temperatures and rainfall, accompanied with low humidity levels, were welcomed weather patterns across most of Illinois last week, which facilitated the dry up of many of the water holes that existed in corn and soybean fields. Topsoil moisture supplies now stand at 1% very short, 7% short, 68% adequate, and 24% surplus. Growing degree day units since May 1 ended the week at 1,283, which was 109 units, or 9% ahead of the historic average. Statewide, corn in the silking stage advanced to 46%, compared to 5% last year and 19% for the five-year average. The average height of corn now stands at 67 inches, well above last year's 39 inches, and the five-year average of 54 inches. Overall, the corn crop was rated in 68% good or excellent condition, up 1 percentage point from last week. Soybean blooming progress ended the week at 20%, and this compares to 4% last year and 20% for the five-year average. 2% of soybeans have begun setting pods compared to 1% a year ago and 1% for the five-year average. Overall, the soybean crop was rated in 59% good or excellent condition, down 3 points from last week. The soft red winter wheat crop was reported at 97% ripe, compared with 88% 1 year ago and 93% for the five-year average. Wheat harvest advanced to 85% complete, compared to 60% last year and 74% for the five-year average. This has been Brad Schwab with the Illinois Field Office of the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service in Springfield.
This is David Biar of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service with the crop weather report for the week ending July 4th, 2010. A mostly dry week with sunshine allowed producers back into fields to spray herbicides and harvest hay. However, statewide rainfall on Sunday again shut down field activities. Rainfall has allowed some producers to turn off irrigation wells. Wind and hail this week again caused damage to scattered fields. Previously flooded fields were assessed to see if replanting is necessary. High numbers of grasshoppers were present in some panhandle counties. Irrigated corn conditions rated 83% good or excellent, and dry land corn conditions rated 84% good or excellent, both near year-ago levels. Soybeans blooming was at 17% complete. Wheat conditions rated 69% good or excellent. Wheat turning color was at 90%. Wheat harvest was mostly complete in the southeast and progressing westward. Dry beans emerged was 94% complete, and proso millet planting was at 95%. Oat harvest has begun, and the first cutting of alfalfa is near completion. This is David Biar of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Nebraska Field Office in Lincoln.
This is Doug Hartwig, Director of USDA NAS Minnesota Field Office, with the weekly crop weather report for the week ending July 4, 2010. After a wet June, consecutive days of sunshine during the past week aided crop development. As of July 4th, spring wheat was 91% headed, compared to 28% last year and 62% for the five-year average. 5% of the crop was ripening. Barley was 89% headed. That's 56 percentage points ahead of last year and 26 points ahead of the average. 6% was ripening. 55% of spring wheat was rated in good condition, while barley condition was rated with 43% good and 34% excellent. Oats were 93% headed, 26 points ahead of last year and 15 points ahead of the average. 19% were ripening. Oats were rated with 65% in good condition. Producers across the South have begun to harvest small grains for forage in some areas. 2% of the corn was silking with an average height of 47 inches. Soybeans were 19% blooming with a height of 12 inches. Corn was rated with 58% in good condition and 31% in excellent condition, while soybeans were rated with 60% in good condition and 23% in excellent condition. That's the weekly crop weather for the week ending July 4th, 2010. I'm Doug Hartwig, Director of USDA NAS, Minnesota Field Office.
And I'm Todd Gleason. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Wednesday afternoon. In a moment or two, we'll be joined by Matt Blaisdell of the Anderson's Climbers facility in Delphi, Indiana. A quick reminder, you can always visit our website. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. If you'd like to download and listen to our programming, you can do that at any time you'd like, 24 hours a day at willag.org. Matt Blaisdell is here now to take up the agricultural cash grain market. Good afternoon to you, Matt. Thanks for being with us today. We do appreciate that. Matt, if you could for us, please take us through what basis looks like in your area at this time. Well, it looks like Matt's not available at this point, so we'll continue on and see if we can't figure out a way to get hold of him in just a moment here. It does look like Matt's not available this afternoon. We had him on the phone line, but I think he hung up on us. Probably got busy talking to somebody about those cash bids and what's been happening in the marketplace on this Wednesday afternoon, as there was a fairly large jump in the market. Just to recap the numbers, in Chicago, futures jumped in 28¾ cents in the soybeans, up at $9.93 for the July contract. The August at 27¼, higher at $9.67¾, and November beans at $9.32½, settled 32½ cents higher. July corn futures 370¾, up 10¾ cents. The December futures at 389¼, finished a dime higher on the day. And the next year's May contract at $4.09, up 9¼ cents on a Wednesday afternoon. Don't forget that you can visit our website. The address is willag.org. Sign up for our free weekend newsletter there. Dave Dickey's on vacation this week, but we'll return soon enough, so I don't think you'll see a newsletter. Maybe you will, because we have a WASDE report coming out on Friday. Dave will be updating the numbers from the website, and if you get text from us, you'll get those too. That'll happen on Friday morning this week when those World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimate reports come out, and then you'll also get that weekend newsletter. You have to hit subscribe over on the right-hand side of the page at willag.org. And if you've already signed up, you can go back and hit manage your subscription and give us your cell phone number. And at that point, we will also give to you the numbers as a text file. About 10 minutes after they're released at 7:30 a.m. Friday this morning, those are the World Agricultural and Supply Demand Estimates that come out from USDA NAS and the World Agricultural Outlook Board on Friday of this week. It is their July report. In just a couple minutes, we will talk with Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City and take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast here on Illinois Public Media's Closing Market Report. From the University of Illinois campus in Urbana-Champaign.
It's Macaroni Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1568, William Turner died, an English naturalist and botanist. Turner is known as the father of English botany. In 1752, Joseph Marie Jacquard was born, a French silk weaver. He is the inventor of the Jacquard programmable power loom. The machine was controlled by perforated control cards and was the basis for the modern automatic loom. In 1862, the first land-grant act was passed. Public lands were sold for agricultural education. This was the start of many state universities throughout the United States, including right here at the University of Illinois. In 1928, Otto Friedrich Rottweiler perfected the bread slicing machine that he began work on in 1912. The first piece of sliced bread was produced and sold at M.F. Bench's Chillicothe Baking Company on Elm Street in Chillicothe, Missouri. And in 1936, Henry F. Phillips patented the Phillips head screw and screwdriver. By the way, General Motors was convinced to use the screws on its 1936 Cadillac. And by 1940, virtually every American automaker had switched to Phillips screws. And that's this day in agricultural history.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Wednesday afternoon, time to check in on the agricultural weather forecast. Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City is with us. Drew, I didn't think I'd say this, but it's been kind of hot and a little on the dry side. I think we're due for some rainfall. Will we get it?
We will. It does look like we're going to flip the old record here and look at the other side of things for a little while again, so some wetter conditions will come back across the region. I don't know that we can say we're going to have major soakings across the region, except in localized areas. We are going to see that. We've got two frontal systems that will be moving across the Midwest over the next 5 days or so, and both frontal systems will bring opportunity for rain back across the heart of the Midwest. There's many areas from central Illinois eastward that are really drying down from this past several days of warm and restricted precipitation. So you're right. We do need to see the rain, and it is going to come. At the moment, it looks like a lot of erratic distribution on the moisture, though. Some areas are going to get just a few hundredths of an inch. A few areas not too far away from that will end up with 1 to 2 inches. So a lot of variability, a lot of pockets of drying coming up. I think that the biggest rainfall potential right now is actually going to be possible in some of the driest areas, which are from southern Missouri into southern Illinois and southwestern Indiana. Maybe even a portion of western Kentucky. The latest model data at least is suggesting that those areas are most favored for some of the heaviest rainfall here as we go through the next few days. And if that ends up being correct, then we will have made great strides in removing one of the nation's biggest dry pockets.
There's been quite a little bit of a heat wave, too, in the eastern part of the United States. We've had very warm temperatures here. We're 90 degrees or above today in most of the Midwest. Will those kind of temps stay with us?
No, I think they will go away, at least for the Midwestern portions of the region you've described. Some of the Atlantic coastal states will probably see ongoing warmer, biased days coming up. Not as hot as they've been here recently, but they will still have a warmer bias, and that'll be off and on all the way through the next 10 days probably. But for the heart of the Midwest, our temperatures will be cooling down just a little bit and into falling back into a more seasonable range. A lot of upper 80s and lower 90s expected as we move forward through this next week. And as I mentioned before, there's a couple of cool fronts that are coming. The first one is going to be with us here over the next 48 hours. The second one shows up early next week. And between the two of them, there's not much opportunity for really much heating between the events. So I think we'll probably stay away from the warmer biased conditions until we get into the second week of the outlook, starting about this time next week and going on forward into that July 20th to 21st period. And during that time period, we'll probably see a lot more warmer weather across the region. But it will still rain, possibly as scattered showers occur. It's really not a bad scenario. But remember, it is July, and it is hard for us to counter evaporation sometimes at this time of the year. So even though we're going to have some showers in the forecast during the second week of the outlook, we'll still probably fall a little bit behind the evaporation rate. So we'll probably slowly dry down again, which makes these next two rain events pretty important for moistening up the soil.
Drew, thanks so much.
Have a great day.
You too. Drew Lerner is with World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Wednesday afternoon. If you can, stay with us for the farming world. It comes up next. If not, you can always hear it online at willag.org. We'll talk about the Obama administration's childhood obesity initiative. This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with Kevin Concannon. He's USDA Undersecretary for Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services. Earlier this past spring, the White House released a task force on childhood obesity paper. Mr. Concannon is part of that task force and has worked, I think, on the paper. Mr. Concannon, thank you so much for joining us today from your Washington, D.C. office.
Here, Todd. Happy to be here.
Can you tell me first about yourself and what you do at USDA?
Well, I'm the Undersecretary for Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services, as you mentioned, and our primary mission is divided into two areas. We oversee 15 of the nation's feeding programs. They are the first line of defense for people across the country, the largest, and those programs currently touch the lives directly of 1 in 4 Americans. The largest program is the SNAP program, what used to be the food stamp program, serving now 40.4 million Americans as of April of this year. And the school lunch program serves about 32 million American children in public and private schools. And then we have other programs like the WIC, the Women, Infants, and Children. It's a special nutrition program for pregnant women. That serves 49% of the births in the United States and the pregnant mothers and infants in the first year of life. So we have other feeding programs as well, but those are the three largest.
We know that obesity tends to be a problem in the United States. Why is it that the White House has taken up this issue as it relates to childhood?
Well, I think one of the president, even before he was elected, made a commitment to end childhood hunger in the United States. And I often cite the fact that I lived happily in the state of Iowa, where we grow a lot of corn and soybeans and raise chickens and produce eggs and lots of other commodities. There is no question in my mind about the ability of American agriculture to produce the food to feed everybody in the country. It's a matter of having the will and the organizational capacity to make sure it gets into the hands of people who need it. And that's where these 15 feeding programs come into play. Now, the issue of obesity, more directly to your question, I think has really risen on the charts, particularly so in that it is now really one of the largest public health problems in the country, with more than 60% of adults either overweight or obese. And during the last three decades, the childhood obesity rate in the U.S. has tripled. And it really came home here in Washington, D.C., the issue, when a group of retired generals and admirals formed an organization called Mission Continuance, where they a private foundation, where they had looked at the experience of young people between the ages of 17 and 24 applying for military service. And they found that only 25% of American male and female between 17 and 24 currently qualify for military service. And the reasons for that disqualification are dropping out of school, inadequate education, having a criminal record, having other health conditions, and the largest single factor, 27%, are so overweight or so obese that they don't qualify. And when those admirals and generals came to Capitol Hill, they really got people's attention. And I think that, plus the White House, the First Lady's Let's Move initiative, saying, look, we have to have kids eat healthily, but we also have to have them exercise. I've been in amazing parts of the country, most recently on an Indian reservation in northern Minnesota, where a local tribal representative said to me, you know, one of our biggest challenges, when the kids get off the school bus, they go right into the house and they either turn on a TV or their computer screens. And activity is a huge challenge for us with young people. So that contributes to obesity. That and eating a lot of processed foods, many more processed foods in this country than any other Western country in the world.
But what can USDA and the task force do about it?
Well, I think first and foremost, I think the fact that you get the White House and the First Lady elevating public awareness on it and emphasizing the fact that we pay for this, and I think the estimates are $157 billion a year in healthcare costs in the U.S. related to obesity or being overweight. And so I think, one, elevating the awareness in the public that, hey, we have to do something about this, and it's not just a nice thing to do. It really relates to our security and our future in terms of healthcare costs and quality of life. And so part of the efforts, one of the recommendations in the Obesity Task Force is make sure that kids get a healthy start in life with good prenatal care, support for breastfeeding. We do a lot of work with the Centers for Disease Control and with other parts of the federal government, the National Institute of Health, and breastfeeding has enormous, enormous benefits to both the child and the mom. And we do well in this country on breastfeeding rates for people of higher education and higher income. It's more of a challenge for poorer people, so one of our goals in the WIC program is to increase that breastfeeding rate as an example. And that's an example of getting kids off and their parents off to a good start. Empowering parents also. I was on a panel here before Congress back in the fall where a researcher from Yale University read his opening line was a paragraph of chemical terms. And he said, you know what that was? That was a breakfast tart. But there were so many, you know, chemicals in it that the average American, even if you are a conscientious parent, you it's a struggle for you to know, is this a healthy food for my child or for me? So part of the efforts around the Obesity Task Force is more transparency, to use a word, more understandability. Let's make it understandable. And I know there's been some work across the federal agencies with the FDA and the USDA and the food safety part of the USDA on improving front-of-package labeling, for example. We've also made some recommendations that due to Congress by the 15th of July on advertising of foods to children between the ages of 2 and 17. It's no surprise that on a Saturday morning, in between those cartoons, there are a gazillion ads for various food products. And guess what? Kids are very persuadable. And so when they go through the supermarket with their parents, you know, they reach out, I want to try this or that. And some of these, everything in moderation, but some of these foods in as a regular diet contributes to that whole issue of that plus the absence of physical activity.
It appears from the recommendations that I read that many of these can be done in part by U.S. government partnership. Much of them, it seems, might need to be voluntarily done as well by restaurateurs, for instance, portion size. How do you, as part of the U.S. government, get folks involved in a way that allows them to do such things or forces them voluntarily, I suppose?
I like to use the word nudge. You know, there's a very popular book that's been written by a behavioral economist, I think, on referring to nudge, where you kind of, you know, you line things up so that you're not forcing somebody, but you encourage them in a particular direction. And we have something in the USDA, a category called Healthier U.S. School Challenges. And these are 720 schools across the country that are exemplary in terms of both the foods that they serve in the school, but they also prohibit in those schools what are called competitive foods. You're not going to get junk foods. You're not going to have an a la carte line where the rest of the kids have the main meal here, but I'm going to have, you know, something that's too much sugar or too much fat or too much fried food. And we know that if we get kids started, and I certainly believe this, if we can get kids started eating properly in schools, in those 700 plus schools that I mentioned, teachers have given me examples, the school nurses have given me examples, that the kids then, when they go with their parents to the supermarket, they want to reach out for the fruit or the vegetables because they've had that experience. So I believe that the school feeding program is, again, serving 32 million American children each day have lunch at a public or a private school that the FNS supports. And if we can improve that meal quality, and that's our goal, we sought advice from the National Academy of Sciences, and they put together a team of physicians and nutritionists, and I think they even had a behavioral economist to make recommendations to us to improve the meal quality in school meals. And some schools do an extraordinary job. Other schools, it's much less, it doesn't draw your attention to saying this is a fabulous experience. And so we're promoting more schools, and we're creating some incentives to, we're going to pay schools, that's what we're proposing, for pay them a premium or pay them an additional amount of money for performance, for serving better meals. But Congress, I think, largely influenced by that group of admirals and generals, is recommending that USDA have the authority to regulate all foods that are in American schools that participate in these school programs. Now, that's not because they want the federal government to be Big Brother. That's because they recognize that if kids are given a choice of, have another ice cream bar versus have, a green or leafy vegetable, they're liable to go over to the ice cream bar. And I think there's a recognition here that we need to just make improvements systematically across the country for our young people.
Is it possible for USDA to push healthier foods through the food supply system that goes into the school? And I'm not quite certain that I know how all of that works.
Well, the USDA itself provides about 20% of the foods that go to schools through what used to be called commodities in the days of old. They're no longer called that. We refer to them as USDA foods, and they no longer have, if you're familiar with them, they no longer have those black and white labels on them. They have a commercial label, but those USDA foods have been now, for at least the past 15 years, systematically improved in terms of the health quality. They have less sodium in them. I was looking at, cans of corn and cans of string beans at a food warehouse up in Milwaukee earlier this week, and it has less sodium than you would get in the commercial packers, and the fruits are all packed in fruit juice, not in sugar syrup. And so we've taken steps to make our foods, that portion of it, healthier. But I'd say in general, one of the challenges we still have in schools, too many processed foods. And part of that is it's easier if you're having to feed, 600 kids. It's easier. It's very tempting to rely upon those processed foods. So we're trying to influence schools back to more basic approaches. And one of the strategies we have here in the department is what we call farm to school, where we're encouraging school systems to procure fruits and vegetables locally. So we have a team that is traveling around the country right now interviewing 15 school systems that are already doing local procurements, but they're also interviewing the farmers in those areas to say, how can we facilitate this for you? Because as school systems will tell you, the easiest thing for them right now is to just call one of the major providers, wholesalers, and they get it to them. But to engage with local area farms, we think it's in the interest of schools to engage the local area farms for reasons of helping the local economy, certainly, but also that effect of having fresh, healthy foods that kids will consume.
You're listening to The Farming World. We're talking today with Kevin Concannon. He's USDA Undersecretary for Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Here's something of interest from the University of Illinois.
If you're serious about losing weight, check out recent studies done in Elvira de Mejia's University of Illinois laboratory. Her research provides insight into the way a certain type of soy protein inhibits fat accumulation and reduces inflammation. She found that soybeans, rich in beta-conglycanins, limit lipid accumulation in fat cells by inhibiting an enzyme called fatty acid synthase. She also identified the specific digested proteins that do this and is beginning to understand the mechanism behind it. De Mejia believes this exciting research could lead to the development of nutraceuticals to fight obesity. Using the latest molecular marker-assisted breathing techniques, soybeans with the right composition can be tagged and later identified using a simple leaf tissue sample. This could make it possible to create high-yielding cultivars that contain the slimming trait for soybean farmers to grow in their fields. And that's something of interest from the University of Illinois.
Something of Interest is a public service of the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. Our guest is USDA Undersecretary for Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services, Kevin Concannon. We're talking about the White House Task Force on Childhood Obesity that was released earlier this spring. When we last spoke with Mr. Concannon, we were discussing the food supply in schools. I want to take up one other issue as well in the last part of this program. It's something we call a food desert. It's generally in an urban area, but there are food deserts in rural America. Can you define that term for me, please?
Yes, there are food deserts, as you say, not only in large urban areas, but out in rural areas. I'm familiar, you know, parts of Iowa where I lived out in the smaller towns, where a food desert can be described as a place where it might have one, you know, mini-mart store, but really nothing in the form of what we would consider to be a reasonably sized supermarket. And so there is a federal initiative the president has proposed that would involve the Department of Treasury, the Department of Health and Human Services, and USDA. And the intent is to stimulate through loans and other approaches the development of food stores that would have more choices, particularly fruits and vegetables and healthier foods for consumers in areas of the country that for which there are long distances they have to travel to get to even a small size supermarket. Those small mini marts invariably have fewer choices and they're almost universally more expensive. And so part of the effort to promote the Healthier Foods Initiative, FFI, I think are the letters associated with it here, is to really try to address some of those areas. And I recall when I was in Des Moines, Iowa, a section of the city not too far from Drake University, very poor, distressed neighborhoods, had no supermarket. And to me, it was an example of, you know, in a mid-sized city, of great quality of life for most people there. If you lived in that poorer section of the city of Des Moines, you were quite a ways from, you know, the supermarkets.
One of the recommendations that comes from the task force says that USDA should update the dietary guidelines and the food pyramid to provide parents and caregivers some information about nutrition, and they need to work with Congress to do that this year.
Yes, we are updating those diets. Every 5 years, the dietary guidelines are promulgated, and that responsibility is shared between the USDA, our Center for Nutrition Policy and Promotion, and HHS, or the Federal Health and Human Service Agency. This year, in this cycle, the lead agency is ours, and we are currently in the middle of a public comment period because the committee itself made their recommendations to the USDA, and the committee was made up of physicians and nutritionists, and they had, I think, a behavioral health or behavioral economist as well. And they basically, their recommendations are for us to go towards more plant-based foods, less salt, less sugar, more fish in our diet, more leafy greens, more fruits, and less sugar, and more whole grains as well. So our staff are receiving public comments right now, and they will promulgate those guidelines toward the latter part of this year. I can't think of another committee report of almost any kind that has such a pervasive effect as those dietary guidelines, because they then become incorporated into all of the federal, whether it's the military or the Veterans Administration, or it influences the health agencies of the U.S. and obviously USDA. And the basic intent is to nudge, direct, educate people, Americans, in the direction of eating healthier. And that is a huge challenge we have, because even though Americans intellectually may know they should be eating better, it's a very small percentage of them that actually adhere to those dietary guidelines. So we're brainstorming these days ourselves and with people over in the White House about what other ways could we really get people's attention so that they are much more responsive in this direction. Now, part of it also is the foods that are available. So when you go through the supermarket, you need to have foods that are going to attract you and that you're going to purchase and use that are healthy for you. So there's a lot of dialogue with the manufacturing side and the food processors as well. But I think they recognize that we've reached a point in the country where it's not in anybody's long-term interest for these obesity rates to remain unaddressed.
Were the dietary guidelines published in the Federal Register for comment period?
Yes, they were. To be precise, it was the recommendations of the committee to the dietary guidelines. I've seen some media stories that say dietary guidelines are promulgated. They won't be promulgated until we promulgate them later this year. But it's the recommendations, and they have been in the Federal Register, and I think the comment period closes toward the end of July, this month. There's the 30-day comment period.
Mr. Concannon, thank you so much for taking the time. It went very quickly today.
Same here. Yeah, thank you, Todd. Yep.
Kevin Concannon is USDA Undersecretary for Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services. You've been listening to The Farming World. We've been talking about the White House Task Force on Childhood Obesity. I'm Todd Gleason.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.